Well, we've been in a series on Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes with a subtitle of Confused in Life, but Confident in God. We know that the author of Ecclesiastes is Solomon, the wisest man who, according to Jesus, ever lived and whoever would live. And yet with wisdom comes responsibility. And we see that this is an individual who struggled with finding peace and contentment and happiness. As we looked at over the last few weeks, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, he sets out in search of this enjoyment, this contentment that one should be able to find. And he was probably more able than many to seek this effort because he had all the wisdom and wealth and power that a person could have at that in that point in history. And he discovered in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 that the vanity of wisdom, that having all knowledge and all wisdom is not enough to bring peace and contentment to our lives. Chapter 2. He looked at, okay, if it's not wisdom, then what else might bring that contentment into our lives? And so he looked at the vanity as a pleasure of having things or servants and the sex attitude and musicians in his life and the riches of gold and jewels and the like. And none of it worked for him as well. And then he said, well, if I just pour myself into my work, if I just have the vanity of work, and he found that that too was meaningless. Which is the phrase for this whole book, meaningless and under the sun. In chapter 3, we were reminded that everything has a time. It has its season in life. And in fact, we know that these seasons are there not because of chance or luck or because of things we've done, but because of God's providence in our life, that He is sovereign in our life, that God has a perfect plan that includes just what we need, but that includes the painful as well as the pleasant. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 12. So I concluded, there is nothing better than to be happy and enjoy ourselves as long as we can. And people should eat and drink and enjoy the fruits of their labor, for these are gifts from God. And I know that whatever God does is final. Nothing can be added to it or taken from it. God's purpose is that people should fear Him. What is happening now has happened before, and what will happen in the future has happened before, because God makes the same things happen over and over again. Now, as we go forward in the chapter 3, the last of chapter 3, and into chapter 4 and chapter 5, here we've gone a chapter a week. Now we're going into 2.5 chapters today. But we notice that whenever a tragic circumstance occurs or a terrible injustice is revealed, somebody is sure to say, you know, you say your God is a God of love. But how could a God of love allow this to happen or allow that to happen? And it's a concern for many. Sometimes the question is more personal. How can you say that God loves me when He lets me work my fingers to the bone, but somebody who perhaps inherited their wealth gets to spend their days enjoying themselves, and I don't have that pleasure? How is that a God of love? And so we have these questions, and in fact, Solomon himself had these questions as well. And if we accept that these are God's choices for us, coming from His loving heart, not out of anger, not out of desire to punish, but out of love, we discover three wonderful things. We'll be enabled to enjoy all of life, even the painful circumstances. We'll learn to know God, and this lesson will be repeated for us until we learn it, until we get it down right, over and over and over again. Now, there followed immediately here four frequently voiced objections that appear to contradict this idea that God has a wonderful plan for our lives, for your life and for mine. The first is injustice. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 16. I also notice that under the sun there is evil in the courtroom. Yes, even the courts of law are corrupt. I said to myself, in due season God will judge everyone, both good and bad, for their deeds. He moved on in verse 18. I also thought about the human condition, how God proves to people that they're like animals. For people and animals share the same fate, both breathe and both must die. So people have no real advantage over the animals, and how meaningless that is. Both go to the same place. They came from dust, and they return to dust. For who can prove that the human spirit even goes up, and the spirit of animals goes down? So I saw there is nothing better than people than for people than to be happy in their work. That is our lot in life, and no one can bring us back to see what happens after we die. See, in the place where justice ought to be found, in the courts and in our judicial system, we find instead injustice. The searcher gives us two answers. The final justice still lies yet ahead. There is justice. Justice will be here. It just isn't here yet. that God has appointed a time when he will bring to light all the hidden things and justify all the things. And that we share with animals a beastly quality. And it's not hard to look on the news sometimes and see the beastly aspect of humanity and the negative things that come out. The second thing he talks about is oppression. Chapter 4, verse 1. Again, I observed all the oppression that takes place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed with no one to comfort them. The oppressors have great power and their victims are helpless. So I concluded that the dead are better off than the living. But most fortunate of all are those who are not yet born, for they've not seen all the evil that is done under the sun. And again, remember that phrase, under the sun, suggests those without God, those that are down here on the earthly level. And he records the anguish and the misery that he causes, the tears of the oppressed, and that there's no one to comfort them. And he doesn't right now answer this, but that's just for the moment. He will later here. The third one is envy and ambition. What is mankind's greatest motivating passion? Most people are motivated to success because they envy their neighbors. But this too is meaningless, like chasing the wind. People really don't want things. They want to be admired for the things they have. What they want is not the new car itself, but to hear their neighbors say, "How lucky you are to have such a wonderful, beautiful car." That's what people really want, to be the center, to be the focus of attention, based on envy, based on ambition and pride. And then there are those who take the opposite beg and drop out altogether, but Solomon answers that too in verse 5. Fools fold their idle hands, leading them to ruin. When you just sit in idleness and do nothing, your resources disappear, your self-respect vanishes, and you're left in total ruin. It would be much better, says the searcher, to lower your expectations. Choose just a slightly less ambitious lifestyle. In verse 6, and yet better to have one handful with quietness than two handfuls with hard work and chasing the wind. So powerful is ambition and the desire to be envied that men actually keep working and toiling even when they have nobody to actually impress. Verse 7, I observed yet another example of something meaningless under the sun. This is the case of a man who's all alone without a child or a brother, yet who works hard to gain as much wealth as he can. But then he asks himself, who am I working for? Why am I giving up so much pleasure now? It's also meaningless and depressing. You know, long ago, a gentleman by the name of Howard Hughes was a big man in the eyes of many and certainly in the news. He was the creator of the Spruce Goose, which I believe you can still see in Long Beach, right? And was known for many aviation statistics. He directed and produced many movies of Hollywood. He dated many of the starlets of that time. He was in the news constantly, but then he dropped out of the news. And he just became a recluse. With all of his money, with all of his wealth, he became reclusive. When they found him, when he had died, they found that he suffered from malnutrition. His reclusiveness and possible drug use made him almost unrecognizable. His hair, his beard, his fingernails and toenails were unkempt and extremely long. His tall 6'4" frame now weighed barely 90 pounds. And the FBI had to use fingerprints to conclusively identify the body. This is someone who had it all, and yet had had nothing. In contrast, the searcher says that companionship is better than loneliness. Verse 9, very famous passage. Two people are better off than one, for they can help each other succeed. If one person falls, the other can reach out and help. But someone who falls alone is in real trouble. Likewise, two people lying close together can keep each other warm, but how can one be warm alone? A person standing alone can be attacked and defeated, but two can stand back to back and conquer. Three are even better, for a triple braided cord is not easily broken. The very best investment you'll ever make in life is not going to be a financial one. It's not going to be your house or your car, but rather the investment you make in relationships. And the searcher mentions that there's so many benefits that it increases the reward. It says that two are better than one, and two certainly do make more than one. Two can live cheaper than one. It also mentions provides help in time of trouble. Somebody to be there for you when you go through things that are hard and troubling. How can one be warm alone? And not just in the physical sense that we might imagine that bringing up in our minds, but the idea that we live in a very cold world, and it takes others to bring warmth into that environment. And it makes defeat less likely. You know, the armies under Alexander the Great, they perfected this idea of standing back to back in their fights, their wars, their battles. And that allowed them to be able to take on any front, whatever was coming at them, protect the one behind me at all costs. And it worked. And I like the last part. Three are even better, for a triple-graded cord is not easily broken. I'm not sure that Solomon actually meant it for this way, but think of it this way. If two are great, imagine two with God and how that strength can be magnified as well. You know, the Bible is full of pairs of individuals who lived off of each other, who grew strength from each other. We hear of Paul and Timothy, of Mary and Martha, David and Jonathan, Ruth and Naomi, Moses and Aaron, Elijah and Elisha. See, God never meant us to be alone. People need someone who will come alongside and join them arm in arm in their fight, in the daily fight. Life is hard. Bad things happen. Tough times come. But if we're standing shoulder to shoulder, we're locked arm in arm, we cannot fall. There's this one reason why we need to come to church. I hope you see the church. I hope you see this church as a safe haven. I want you to see Maranatha as a place of community. Yes, we have our issues. Every family does. But the only way to make a difference in the world is not to move away from the church, but move together as the church. We make sure that we're fighting the battles that need to be fought. We make sure we're working together as brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ. We do our best to make sure that we're using our talents and using our time and using our treasures so the church can be exactly what Jesus calls us to be, a place of redemption and a place of transformation. Fourthly, he saw a lifetime of seeking. The moral here is that God has a perfect plan and he'll teach you as you go. If you live long enough and listen carefully, you will learn that enjoyment is a gift of God. But sadly, even people who live a long time still do not seem to learn this. He goes on in verse 13, it's better to be a poor but wise youth than an old and foolish king who refuses all advice. Such a youth could rise from poverty and succeed. He might even become king, though he's been in prison. But then everyone rushes to the side of yet another youth who replaces him. Endless crowds stand around him, but then another generation grows up and rejects him too. So it's all meaningless, like chasing the wind. Although a long life usually does teach a lot of lessons, living a long time does not teach us all the lessons. And a wise youth certainly is better than an old foolish king. It all remains meaningless, like chasing the wind. If you're still here in 20 years, you will not be the same person you are now. But the question is, will you be a deeper Christian? Will you be a wiser person? Or will you harden and sour and stagnate 20 years from now? So there we have again the four arguments that might be brought against God's hand being there and strongly involved in our existence. Injustice and oppression and motivation by envy and ambition that not even a lifetime of searching can find. And in chapter 5, after this wonderfully positive outlook in chapter 4, the searcher answers these objections in a wonderful way. First, verse 1, as you enter the house of God, keep your eyes open and your mouth shut. Learn to let God be God. God is in charge, but we need to let him be in charge. It was brought up in prayer time today. We need to keep our eyes open. We need to be looking for where God is working in our midst. What the searcher is saying is when you gather together as the people of God, look for God, for what God would have you learn. No matter how educated we are, there's always something more to be learned. I know not too long ago I had somebody who stopped coming to the church and said that the reason was is they'd been in church all their life and they already knew everything they needed to know about God in the Bible. But as we read the scriptures, we realize that it's a living document in the sense that we are always learning something from God's word. To learn to let God be God. And then listen carefully, verse 1. Again, it is evil to make mindless offerings to God. Don't make rash promises and don't be hasty in bringing matters before God. After all, God is in heaven and you are here on earth. So let your words be few. Too much activity gives you restless dreams. and too many words make you a fool. See, God is in the heavenly realm, and that's why he sees so much more than we do. You know, as I look out, I see many bodies here today, and they reveal certain things. Some of you are interested. Some of you are asleep, but that's okay. But there's no way that I could ever really, truly understand the tremendous complexity and the depth of the struggles that many of you are going through right now in your lives. But God does. See, God not only sees you, he sees what's inside of you. Even what you cannot see for yourself. He sees your heredity. He sees your environment. He sees your struggles. He sees it all. And so why don't we let him be in charge? Thirdly, he goes, don't play games with God. Verse 4, when you make a promise to God, don't delay in following through, for God takes no pleasure in fools. Keep all the promises you make to him. God expects us to carry out our word. This ought to teach us to be careful about what we promise God. Don't make idle promises, for he is not pleased with fools. You may be thinking, well, how have people broken their vows to God? Who makes promises to God? Well, think about these, for instance, our marriage vows before people and witnesses and God. And yet we so quickly toss them aside, like, well, we really didn't mean what we were saying. Dedication of children vows. You know, we dedicate the kids, and then when we say, you know what, we're going to raise them up in the nurture of the Lord, and then we fail to do so. Salvation vows, vow to do things God's way, but then we find out that's a little difficult, and so we say, no, we've got a better way. Or giving vows, making pledges to give back to God what is already his, and yet we don't do it. And other promises to God, when they're delivered, they don't do it. Why do people do this? Because they don't take God seriously. Don't have a holy awe for a living creator God. You know, there's a movie called The End, and I remember it from my younger days, and as I looked at clips on YouTube, I cannot actually suggest that you guys watch The End. In fact, I had to write down a clip rather than show you a clip because of things that were in it. But it kind of gives that this idea of the vows that we make so flippantly to God. After discovering he has only months to live, Wendell Lawson, played by Burt Reynolds, becomes distraught, and he sets out to kill himself, and he tries unsuccessfully attempt after attempt after attempt. In one attempt, he swam far out from shore, only to discover he wanted to live, actually. And in his swim back to shore, Wendell tries to negotiate with God. And he says, I promise not to try and kill myself anymore. Save me, and I swear I'll be a better father. I'll be a better man. I'll be a better everything. Just all I ask is you make me a better swimmer right now. Oh, God, let me live, and I promise to obey every one of the Ten Commandments. I will not kill. I will not commit adultery. I'll learn the Ten Commandments, and then I'll obey every single one of them. Just get me back to the beach. I'll be honest in business. I promise I won't sell any more lakeside properties unless there's a lake around the property. Help me to make it. I'll give you 50% of everything I make, and I want to point out, God, nobody gives 50% of everything. I'm talking gross here, God. I think I'm going to make it. I'm actually going to make it. You are not going to regret this, Lord. I'll obey every commandment. I'll see my parents more often. No more cheating in business once I get rid of those 9 acres in the desert. And I'm going to start donating that 10% right away. I know I said 50%, Lord, but 10% to start. Certainly that'll be a help. Notice as he gets back on his feet that all of a sudden those promises to God were kind of not well kept. Verse 5, it's better to say nothing than make a promise and not keep it. Don't let your mouth make you sin, and don't defend yourself by telling the temple messenger that the promise you made was a mistake. That would make God angry, and he might wipe out everything you've achieved. Talk is cheap, like daydreams and other useless activities. Fear God instead. God is not cruel. God is not heartless. He's loving, but he's real, so don't play games with him. Pay attention when you're hearing the words of God. Listen as he describes living life to you. He's telling you so that you might find enjoyment all that you do. Fourthly, he mentions the value of government. Verse 8, don't be surprised if you see a poor person being oppressed by the powerful, and if justice is being miscarried throughout the land. For every official is under orders from higher up, and matters of justice just get lost in red tape and bureaucracy. Even the king milks the land for his own profit. We need to recognize that there is good in government. The government is put in place by God. sometimes not the best of governments, but government is there. We cannot live in anarchy. Someone has once said that even bad government is better than no government at all. We need to take comfort in that, even when it looks like it's a very restrictive government. Then he moves on to what is probably more on the minds of others. Is money the solution? Is the things that I inherit and get, is that the solution? And he says that money will not satisfy you. Money will not leave you feeling full and enjoying life. Verse 10, those who love money will never have enough. How meaningless to think that wealth brings true happiness. John D. Rockefeller, one of the wealthiest men of that century, after he made all his millions, said, I would give up all that I have now if I could experience the contentment and satisfaction in the days when I was making just $3 a week. He goes on to say, the parasites will gather around you to spend your money for you if you're wealthy. Verse 11, the more you have, the more people come to help you spend it. So what good is wealth except perhaps to watch it slip through your fingers? Thirdly, you'll lie awake at night worrying about how to keep that wealth that you have. Verse 12, people who work hard sleep well, whether they eat little or much, but the rich seldom get a good night's sleep. Fourthly, he says you can lose your riches. Verse 13, there's another serious problem I've seen under the sun. Hoarding riches harms the saver. Money is put into risky investments that turn sour, and everything is lost. And in the end, there's nothing left to pass on to one's children. Everything you have can disappear overnight. Imagine a fire taking out everything you have, or a drop in the stock market. I remember in this last recession we had, a good friend of mine had everything he had for retirement, and he was about to retire, in the stock market. And within 2 days, it would cut in half because of the stock. And so we think we have it all secure. We think we have it safe, and yet any time to the end of our lives as naked and empty-handed as on the day we were born. Verse 15, we can't take our riches with us, and this too is a very serious problem. People leave this world no better off than when they came. All their hard work is for nothing, like working for the wind. Throughout their lives, they live under a cloud. They're frustrated and discouraged and angry. Once again, we come to the true answers in the closing words of this chapter. If you look at verses 18 and 19. Even so, I have noticed one thing, at least this is good. It is good for people to eat and drink and enjoy their work under the sun during the short life that God has given them and to accept their lot in life. And it is a good thing to receive wealth from God and the good help to enjoy it. To enjoy your work and accept your lot in life, this is indeed a gift from God. Enjoyment does not come from possessions or from the riches we might have or the riches we don't have. Nor does it come from companionship, from popularity, or from fame, or from approval and the admiration of others. Enjoyment comes by knowing the living God, pure and simple, and taking everything from his hand with thanksgiving. Whether it be pain or pleasure, knowing that the sovereign God has your life, has your interest at heart. That's the gift of God, and that's the lesson of this book of Ecclesiastes. And notice how the chapter closes with the last verse of chapter 5. God keeps such people so busy enjoying life that they take no time to brood over the past. You know, William Randolph Hearst amassed one of the great fortunes of our time, built the great castle, which is here in California, Hearst Castle. Huge endeavor. But he ended his days living in the opulence and splendor of that castle. He was found sitting in a basement playing over and over and over again the last few weeks of his life, playing the movies of old Hollywood in an effort to eke out some degree of enjoyment from the past, from his time in the past, because today didn't offer it. Tomorrow doesn't offer it for him. How much better to be so involved in today's activities that we have no time to brood in the past. Let's pray.